So explain to me one more time how this works.
You agree to pay the amount of Line 3. We freeze you cryogenically for the entire duration of the Trump presidency, and then we wake you up when somebody new gets elected.
What if you wake me up and Scott Baio is on the Supreme Court?
That's the most common concern we hear. All you do is check an initial box, 8. That means we wake you up and say, Justice Chachi. If you blink twice, we put you right back in the freezer.
What if I can't afford the amount on Line 3?
I can get the price down if you're willing to live without certain options. Like, do you really need the intermittent wipers?
What are those?
Those are people who come in intermittently and, you know, wipe you. Another option you might not need is the lane departure warning.
What's that?
Well, even though everybody is totally frozen, for some reason, occasionally people roll over and wind up kind of flopped up against the person next to them. This option would beep when that happened.
The person next to me? I'm not in my own private capsule?
Oh, no. We had to get this program off the ground ASAP. We bought up a few abandoned Piggly Wiggly supermarkets, so you'll get your own space on a shelf marked off with tape.
You know what? No, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to face this new reality the way great Americans have for generations. With drugs, alcohol, and massive denial in the face of reality. You can keep your crummy freezer. Meanwhile, here's a show about the new America. And now he's letting Glenn Beck hide in his attic. Colin McEnroe.
Right. You'll actually hear more from Glenn Beck. Not, like, literally he was not live on the show or anything, but you will hear Glenn Beck later on in this. It's sort of Glenn Beck 3.0. Anyway, so here's the thing. Obviously, these were maybe not the results many of you wanted, but these are the results. And we're not going to spend a lot of time analyzing those results and figuring out what percentage of, you know, married, college-educated, whatever. I mean, I at the moment, I can't do that. And as a matter of fact, last night, I was telling Jonathan McNichol this. Last night, after we were here in the studios until about 9:30, I went home and I was trying to watch CNN. And John King and his map started to make me almost – I was having like a neurological reaction. You know how some people watch certain TV programs and they have petite mal seizures or something? I was like having almost that reaction. And I also was having the sense that he was making things happen. Like he'd make something, you know, the blue get bigger or smaller or red. And I go, no, that's happening now because you're doing that. Stop it, John. So I think we've all experienced this in one stressful way or another. We're going to have some conversations today about what happens going forward, as they say. Michael Lynch is in studio with me. He's a professor of philosophy and director of the Humanities Institute at the University of Connecticut and the author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. I should say that tomorrow night, Michael Lynch will be appearing at UConn with Alex Hefner of PBS's The Open Mind, one of the longest-running TV series ever, I think, to talk about picking up the pieces of the election at 7 p.m. tomorrow night at Laurel Hall at UConn Storrs campus. You may need that conversation. A little bit later, we're going to talk to David Folkenflik. He is NPR's media correspondent. Obviously, a lot of questions about the media. And then you're going to hear at the end a conversation that I've already recorded with Azar Nafisi, the amazing Iranian-American writer and somebody who lived in Iran under Khomeini and is the author of a bunch of famous books, especially reading Lolita in Tehran. And she has some – I think you'll find some pretty inspiring things to say about how we deal with all this. But Michael Lynch, I'm going to begin with you. Well, first of all, I mean, you know, you're actually hosting Alex Hefner from The Open Mind. Today, Hillary Clinton said that Donald Trump should get from us an open mind and a chance to govern or a chance to lead. I can't remember exactly what her phrase was, but she used the phrase an open mind. Are we capable of that? I mean, and first of all, do you agree with her that he deserves an open mind?
Well, thanks, Colin. Yes, I think that we all deserve an open mind in this sense, the sense that we need to be able to listen to what people are going to propose, not just in his administration, but the people that voted for him. Half of the country voted for Mr. Trump. And I think one of the things that we learned yesterday, many of us, is that the left – we too have been living in our social media bubbles and not really aware of what the rest of the country really was feeling. So in that respect, I think Hillary Clinton is completely right.
And I think one thing, you know, you and I have talked about this in the past, and it's very much a part of your book, too, that notion of living in bubbles. So one thing that I've been trying to say to people is, if you imagine everything there is to know about the past election as a universe of 100%, you could never know it all. I mean, there's just too much detail in terms of who's done what, who said what. I mean, there's more. There's more than the human mind can store. So everybody stores part of it. And one of the things that happens as we begin to segregate ourselves in these information bubbles is we're storing different parts of it. Some of the things we're storing are true. Some of the things are false. But it's really different. I mean, a person with a different political leaning from mine will wind up actually knowing some facts even that I don't.
Yeah, that's
not,
right.
Not that I'm suggesting by the word even that I know all the facts.
No, I understand. And of course, you're exactly right. One of the things that this election has really brought home to us. And in this respect, it's like Brexit, although I think, as a colleague just recently said to me, overstating those comparisons actually underplays the enormity of what just happened in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that we do live in these information bubbles, and they do have a distorting effect on what we think we know and what we actually, as you just put it, do know. Mm-hmm. It also encourages us in us, and this we just saw this, a type of incredible overconfidence, a confidence that we know we have on our fingertips all the facts, because after all, we can all just Google it. And of course, if you can Google anything, of course, it's all there. It gives us the sense that we know more. The other thing that you mentioned, this word truth, there has been revealed in our country a very troubled relationship towards facts and the truth.
Mm.
The very sense right now, of course, we're disagreeing over not just the issues, not even just the facts, but how we actually come about and figure out what those facts are, which is what you were just mentioning. And that's because of our social bubbles. But it's also, of course, because of deeper things too. I think that there has been a growing sort of culture of animosity to the idea that we are somehow through the very idea of objective truth. And I think we're seeing we're paying some of the price for that.
And this is one of the things that's the hardest to address constructively, I think. You know, one of the things that you're very concerned about, one of your big initiatives, is going to be about civil discourse for civic goals. And so some of that begins maybe with an agreed upon set of facts. But I have to say that I'm very interested in solutions. I don't have one sitting in my kitchen cupboard for this.
Right. I think one thing that we need to do is – that's right – is the initiative that we've launched at UConn, which is called Humility and Conviction in Public Life. And I can talk – those are powerful words for today.
Mm-hmm.
Part of our goal is to try to figure out just that puzzle. How do we come up with an agreed upon set of facts when we don't agree on the standards for what a fact is? One of the things that I think is really important to return to this notion of truth and related notions like evidence is we need to start examining – and I mean us. I think people that voted for Clinton need to examine this just as much as people who voted for Trump. What is your commitment to evidence? What is your commitment to the open mind?
Mm-hmm.
When you are engaging with social media, think about how your commitment to evidence is really being displayed when you pass things on unthinkingly and share like I do, like we all do. One of the things I think that is really important is to remember that a basic commitment to evidence is a cornerstone of democratic practice. And that's something that we need to rediscover.
I mean, in some ways, I think what we do now, whichever side we're on, is we use evidence to shore up our pre-existing conviction or sometimes evidence to try to wound the person that we're in an argument with. The interest doesn't begin with evidence or truth as a first thing. Evidence and truth, or what we claim is evidence and truth, is something that we use to accomplish something else.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think right now we're in the situation where, to invert a famous saying, it's now that politics is war by other means rather than the other way around. And I think, indeed a scary thought. I think, you know, one of the things when we talk about, you know, well, what is it that we're using, we're weaponizing evidence, and What are we weaponizing it for? Well, it turns out that a lot of people in the culture right now are weaponizing it in favor of some of their strongest, most deepest convictions, which turn out to have been fear-based, fear of globalization, but also fear of those who do not look like them, those fear of women, fear of people who have different colored skin than their own. Those fears all mixed together in an incredibly toxic combination and then played out on the internet and led by a Pied Piper who was a master at playing the tune on the internet that everyone wanted to hear, or at least some portion of, is, you know, really, I think, why we're seeing, or one of the reasons we're seeing, this weaponization of evidence.
Right. But, you know, and I think you would agree that that a countervailing fear, like fear of rednecks, isn't any more helpful. Like, well, we've got an ideal situation for examining this because 59 million people voted for Donald Trump and 59 people voted for Hillary Clinton. Exactly. And then, you know, the game is just out there at the margins after that. She actually has won the popular vote so far anyway by a slight margin. But see, you've got some nicely balanced groups here. It's unlikely that 59 million people on either side are sickos or orcs or some kind of depraved being. The greater likelihood, and you were quoting Keats, I think, to my producer, Jonathan, today, the best lack all conviction while the worst are filled with passionate intensity. We tend to hear from the people who have passionate intensity. You know, they represent a small sliver of each 59 million person contingent.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're absolutely right that we can't. I mean, it's a mistake, as actually Clinton and Obama have just been saying today, to do the very thing that we might have feared the other side was doing, which is to fall into demonizing the other half of the country. Which is not to say that there aren't, of course, legitimate fears here about what a Trump presidency might do to a certain portion of our country and the country as a whole. Nonetheless, you're exactly right that weaponizing evidence still further, ratcheting up the arms race, is not the way to dig ourselves out of this hole. One of the things that I think we really need to think about is the sort of growing culture of self-defensiveness that we're in right now. Mm-hmm. It's as if both halves of the country are in this self-defensive crouch, and this crouch that leads to a type of arrogance, a sense that you've got the moral truth, and as a result, you've got moral superiority and certainty. Now, that may be true in certain cases, right, that some people know certain things that other people don't. Some people are right on the right side of history. Some people aren't. But the conviction that I know it all and I actually don't have to listen to the other side, that the other side really is not worth talking to, that I can't learn anything from them, that's something we really need to be careful of.
I was sort of trying to think of a laboratory for all this. I mean, not a laboratory that you or I can inhabit. But one thing that I was thinking about is it would be interesting if the leadership of the Senate were to get together and say, all right, so we've had some problems confirming a Supreme Court justice so far. We're going to have more problems. I mean, Democrats can exercise filibuster options. There's all kinds of things that can happen. So what if we have a conversation right now about how this could work, you know, what's acceptable, what's not, you know, what set up some civil and civic rules for this process, and maybe even a little bit of compromise. Like, what if you guys were to confirm Merrick Garland right now before the inauguration? And in return, we would be willing to have this conversation with you about future nominees. It seems like that's the kind of conversation we don't have either at the level of the U.S. Senate or just, you know, walking around, you know, a state forest with some friends of ours.
Yeah, that's exactly that we don't have those sorts of conversations. Mm-hmm. And I don't think either you or I actually expect that sort of ideal that you just played out, that sort of possibility of compromise, is something that we right now expect to happen. I think what we in fact really right now are seeing, I think, is that the Republicans are have solidified their control on power in Congress and in the executive branch. And their own constituency, of course, is going to be pressing them not to compromise, to actually follow through with the things that they've said they're going to do, or at least Trump said he was going to do. And I think if I was in a mainstream Republican, and I know many down in D.C. who I know are right now terrified of what they just created, because they are going to have to make that choice about whether they're going to have this compromise, whether they're going to actually open their minds, or whether they're going to fall in line with the steps of the creature that they just created.
All right. We're going to grab a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more to Michael Lynch and to David Folkenflik about the role the press plays in all this.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
I guess as a country, we are not ready for a female president, and I feel a lot more of this has to do with misogyny than Trump being a Washington outsider.
We are so screwed. The planet is screwed because with the climate science denier in the White House, who really doesn't believe science, I'm afraid nothing is going to be done to stem the single largest problem that we as humanity face.
I will continue to advocate and to be an activist with the people in the Bernie coalition and hope that we can help make the world better and that it does not get burned down by people like Donald Trump.
What did you think was going to happen when people said Bernie or bust? This is the bust part.
Reality has set in, 8 a.m., my student Manny hysterically crying that he won't be able to see his grandma in Mexico if Trump builds a wall. Kids on the bus chanting, build the wall in his face and go back to Mexico. This is what is to come, and it's heartbreaking. I feel like I'm at a funeral.
Well, reality has now set in. The proverbial dog has caught the car.
And very disappointed, and can see that our country is racially as divided as it ever has been, and I don't know which way to turn. At the very least, I'm sick, I'm upset, and I'm tired.
We might be able to get something out of this in the end. Consider that Donald Trump did have a message bolstering middle America, and there's something for all of us out of this if we keep our heads up.
This vote is the last gasp of the haters, the fearful, the backward-looking. We are the future. We are the promise of the future waiting for others to catch up.
I only hope that just like Trump surprised me after the primaries and by winning the election, he'll surprise me by actually being a decent president.
Think very locally about what we can do with our neighbors to build resilience, to have fun, and to love each other.
All right. We are back. We are having a conversation, hopefully a constructive conversation. Obviously, a lot of despair and despondency in the air, but hopefully a constructive conversation with Michael Lynch, a professor of philosophy at UConn and director of the Humanities Institute there. Also joining us now is David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. So, David, before I get a word out of you, I'm going to do something that I typically don't do, and reflecting an experience that I typically don't have, which is that last night, as I thumbed around on my television remote, one of the more sensible things that I heard all night, and I've never spoken these words before, came from Glenn Beck.
Here's Glenn. Even those people who voted for either one of these, they're not happy with it. And so I think on both sides, the parties have to realize now, boy, we need to start reflecting the people and listening to the people, because the people are entering a time, as we're seeing tonight, beyond reason. They're not listening. When you get into so much fear or so much anger, the mind's mechanism is just to shut down reason. And they're not listening to reason. And we have got to find our way to each other. My goal in the next year is to meet with the people I think I disagree with the most and not try to talk them into anything, not try to have an argument with them. Yep. I just want to listen. I want to be able to say, is this what you believe and why you believe it? And when they say yes, then we could even begin to have a conversation. But at least for me, that's a year away before I could have a conversation. We have to start listening to people.
Glenn
if
Beck.
We don't, we're in trouble.
That was Glenn Beck on NBC. Might have said the word listening into too many times, a few too many times. But David Folkenflik, I think there is maybe within the world of journalism a sense that Glenn Beck or Glenn Beck 3.0 or whatever Glenn Beck that was has a point, that we kind of emptied our quiver of all the things that we knew as journalists that we needed to tell people. And somehow or other, those things weren't necessarily a true reflection of the picture.
Well, I think the press, got so many things wrong in this particular election cycle, it's hard to know where to start, right? I think that there was a reflection that somehow Trump's appeal would be limited only to an angry, disaffected, rural white male voters, even if that was not the way in which the coverage actually depicted his individual voters. There certainly was that sensibility left, and as we try to piece through some of the returns and results, it would appear that Trump did much better among women than we expected, given the way in which the press focused on Trump's not only words towards women, particularly individual women he interacted with, but his apparent acts toward them, and thought that would be disqualifying. Well, we may have felt some of those acts and deeds were and words were reprehensible, but voters may have felt that his appeal or his apparent platform or just the tone that he and direction he wanted to set for the nation was more appealing. So I think, if you look at the polls, I think they were just, even the state-by-state polls, most of them proved not to be where they needed to be in terms of reflecting an accurate picture. You know, the punditry talked about a firewall for Hillary Clinton, and that firewall, looked awfully flammable, last night as a red march occurred westward across the electoral map. So I think that the nation's press corps needed to do more to figure out what was happening there. And there was a line I came across, it was pointed out to me on a Twitter this morning from a woman who's a conservative political columnist. She used to work for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review itself, owned formerly by the late Richard Mellon Skife. But she said, I kept telling you guys, folks took seriously what Trump says. Folks took what Trump says seriously, not literally. The media takes what Trump says literally, but not seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so that a lot of the electorate sort of absorbed the tonal notion that Trump's saying things aren't working for us, and the way in which the economy has dislocated so many millions of people isn't working for us. And they weren't looking for him to be a grand thinker. They were saying this guy captures how we feel. And Hillary Clinton, even if she's to the left of Donald Trump on almost all things, reasonably represents an establishment point of view, her ties with Wall Street and other things. And if people in Washington and New York in the press corps thought that that was, stuff that could be finessed, it turned out that wasn't finessable at all for Hillary Clinton.
So I feel as though all of us did this thing where we covered the Trump growth during the primaries and sort of then admitted that we didn't quite understand how big a phenomenon it was, that we were going to retrench, we were going to try to understand it better, and then we covered his nomination and his candidacy to its conclusion, and now we're doing that all over again, saying, well, we got some of that wrong too. And I don't know. I mean, in some ways, this is something that reaches from the data analytics of Nate Silver to the terrific reportage that was done by a lot of legacy organizations, including NPR, and yet somehow or other, it feels so incredibly inadequate. And I wonder, how we begin to address that. I mean, I'm going to ask Michael Lynch that in a second. But, David, I don't know. I mean, is there a summit that needs to be had? Do we all need to sit down and say, well, how did we wind up communicating so much information that ultimately didn't have the kind of utility we thought it had?
Well, first off, I think, my personal approach, and I command a newsroom of none.
Mm-hmm.
I don't speak for NPR. It's NPR's media critic as well as a media correspondent, but my feeling is that we need to enter a moment of great humility about what we can predict will happen, not only in a Trump administration, but how our fellow citizens will act. And I think that we're going to have to think really hard about the promise of data journalism to produce insight that works in the same way that the data revolution produced division winners and World Series champions in baseball. There's a lot of modeling of what's going on in political journalism that seems to me to be following Moneyball and Bill James and what we saw at the Red Sox, which may be an example that's a little more dear to the heart of your listeners than happened out west with the Oakland Athletics for some years with Billy Beane there. But it seems to me that we need to be humble about that. And at the same time, I think that given that Trump's ascendancy was not only unexpected, but in a sense, at least in the modern era, unprecedented, that we're going to have to engage in a muscular era of accountability reporting, figuring out not just what the new president says, but what he does and what the people do in his name, and really be clear on the implications of it. Because, you know, it may well be that Trump was as insincere about some of the things he said about governing as he has apparently been in his personal and business life to date. He often contradicts himself. He often contradicts the facts, and he seems not particularly concerned or shamed by that fact. That's a tough dynamic for the press. Usually shame is a useful way to hold people accountable in both parties, and he seems to be beyond that in all kinds of activities and behavior. But it seems to me that the press is going to have to figure out a way to be at once fair and muscular and attentive. There will be, you know, very little in the way checks and balances, at least initially, that people who oppose him in Congress will have. And that's often a source. You know, you heard, for example, in the run-up to the Iraq invasion in March 2003, you know, you didn't hear a ton of opposition from congressional Democrats. And so people, including the late Tim Russert, who I think was pretty terrific as host of Meet the Press, he said, well, Democrats didn't object, really, to this invasion, and therefore the press didn't either. I did not then and do not now feel that's a good enough bar for determining what the press thinks is worthwhile. I think the press has to be have humility about its omniscience and its role in the great establishment party that it seemed to participate in that I think turned off a lot of voters outside of Washington and New York. But I think it has to be muscular in saying, you know, even at a time of great financial stresses for the media, reporters have to take seriously their role to hold a government accountable and a new administration accountable, even if that the new president is somebody who doesn't believe fundamentally in the role of what the media does.
Michael Lynch, David has twice used that word humility. That is very much a part of your mission. But humility is an easy thing to talk about and a more difficult thing to practice. What's your take on what David's saying?
Well, I think he's right. That's what we were touching on that earlier. I think that not only the press, but a lot of us in the chattering class need to actually start having a sense of humility, and ordinary citizens too. But, you know, really the question is, what sort of humility are we talking about? In my own view, the sense that's really important here now is the idea, the willingness to see your own views and beliefs and opinions as open to improvement by the evidence and the experience of others. The thought that we, you know, that Glenn Beck remarked on and that David also talked about, which is that not really hearing what other people are talking, are saying, but also not thinking about how they're interpreting what you're saying and what Trump was saying. I mean, one of the things that I think really is dead on is that what Trump was saying was his words meant different things to different people, and part of that is dog whistling. But another part is simply that folks were in an emotional state where they wanted to hear those words and they could read into those words as they wished. One of the things that Trump was really good at and is really good at is contradiction, saying one thing and then saying the opposite without apology, without, as David said, without any shame. That what that allows people to do is when contradictions are claimed and asserted with such confidence is to read into that contradiction whatever they think. That's something we need to call him on, but it's also something we need to be willing to see we're vulnerable to ourselves.
We've only got about 4 minutes left here and a lot of ground I wish I would cover. Anyway, David, one of the things that I've started to think is that, you know, the primary cycle of political coverage in a presidential campaign really kind of happens on the campaign trail. And you have these terrific journalists like Katie Tour who are going to the rallies and getting screamed at by the candidate and denounced and stuff. And I don't know, maybe we're spending too much time in the middle of that lane, whereas life is being lived on the banks. There's been some really great reporting of just people wandering around the country talking to people. But they did it to people like George Saunders writing in The New Yorker. I'm wondering if maybe the stuff, the repetitive rallies are over-covered as opposed to the rest of life in America.
Well, and don't forget that they were covering rallies, particularly on cable TV, during the primary season, because we were watching it as viewers. Now, I'm not saying the entire nation was. Cable does well by focusing on niche audiences, but they're large niches as opposed to big broadcasts like an NFL-sized audience. But nonetheless, time after time again, they said they can do that. I was able to report that CNN not only got a huge bump that they expected in revenues from every election cycle. Every 4 years, they know that the cables are going to get a lot of attention. But they got an extra $100 million on top of that because of what was attributed internally and externally to the fascination with Trump that was reflected on CNN's air. And so there's an incredible financial incentive to do that. Well, if you do that, right, if you spend that amount of time, you are kind of to these unexpurgated rallies, you are turning over your airwaves to whatever he says. And often there's fact-checking after the fact. But, you know, in that primary season where there were so many rallies, and I do think the tone shifted right around the conventions and the general election, but when you devote that much time unexpurgated and turn it over to him and not doing it to the other 16 primary candidates, you're essentially saying this guy is the lead. And you know what? In the same moment, they weren't at the major news channels and major news organizations taking seriously the notion he would prevail in the primary or that he could possibly prevail in the general election. So you were giving him blanket coverage and in some ways kind of giving him matador defense, you know, sort of a rather light touch scrutiny. And I think that sets him up to be somebody who suddenly is in a pretty strong position when the general election comes because you've gotten used to him. So the nation's press corps has to decide, you know, we have to listen to the voters whose concerns, anxieties, and hopes he tapped, and we have to be clear on who they are and what they want, and we have to be humble about our ability to predict what they do. And at the same time, I think you need to say, with the nature of this candidate, there's every reason to believe you need to be more muscular in terms of holding him and his administration accountable, and that, you know, in some ways is a norm that I think the press corps is going to struggle with, both because of this notion of fairness, they've been tarred as partisan, and because they're suffering from extraordinary financial pressures, even as we speak.
David Folkenflik, NPR press critic, thank you so much for joining us today. Michael Lynch will be appearing tomorrow at UConn at the Laurel Hall on the UConn Stores campus with Alex Hefner at 7 p.m. Alex Hefner of PBS is the Open Mind. We've got about 30 seconds left. We had one caller who said the last thing he wants to hear is that we have to come together. He's a liberal. He's frightened. I don't know. You got 30 seconds to talk to that person.
Courage. That's what we need to have right now. We need to have the courage of our convictions, and we need to remember that it's okay to be afraid. We should be afraid, but we also need to remember that courage is about overcoming those fears. Courage.
All right. Head on out to UConn and to Laurel Hall tomorrow night and to hear more from Michael of This Kind and Alex Hefner of PBS's The Open Mind. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. When we do, you're going to hear from Azar Nafisi, the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran and other books about how our mental space is the one thing that nobody can take away from us. And it's the one thing that we can use to reimagine our reality.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Katie Talarski is our executive producer, and she appeared in the intro. Our intern was Weepy Fisher. Part of Bill Curry was played by Al Gore. You can find all of our shows at WNPR.org/Colin. And on tomorrow's show, a conversation with Patti Smith. Now, back to Colin.
One of the people I wanted to talk to today was Azar Nafisi. She is a writer and scholar. She is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, Things I've Been Silent About, Memories of a Prodigal Daughter, and The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. And Azar, you and I were together on the Connecticut Forum with John Irving and Jonathan Franzen a long, long time ago. Today I was watching you on Twitter, and you know, I think you were sort of striking a different tone than a lot of people. A lot of people today are understandably demoralized and fearful. And that's not an unreasonable reaction to the election results yesterday. But there are other ways to look at this. And so rather than me put words in your mouth, why don't you share some of your own thinking about this?
No, well, one advantage I have, and I guess this is one advantage of basically being an immigrant, in fact, is that I've been there. Iran is not America, and many things are different. But one thing that was the same was when the system stops working, stop believing in itself, and people are desperate. We always have these monsters that fiction has warned us against. And they always come in the garb of people who are asking, looking after our welfare. They don't come as villains, but as people who can help us out of our misery. And we would be too complacent to understand it. So how I felt we have to deal with this was to understand this and to understand that the violence that comes from them is because of an innate fear of us. So we now need to focus on this domain that we have, you know, and try to see how we can not give in to the domain that they're creating for us.
And, you know, you've experienced far more strict and restricted and repressive environments than even the one we're probably about to head into this country. And I think, you know, one of the aspects of that is that the more things that you feel are taken away from you, the more you rely on your imagination and your thoughts.
I'm so glad you mentioned this because, you know, the last book I wrote, Republic of Imagination, was all about the fact that I felt the crisis we're facing in America today and the crisis we've been facing for the past decade is not, in fact, an economic or a political crisis. These are symptoms of a larger one, which is a crisis of vision. And that is where we are lacking. How could people vote when they don't know anything about themselves, their own history, their own fundamental principles, and they know nothing about the world? Ignorance is really not bliss. It brings with it fear, and it brings with it hatred. And the way I feel is the way we have been replacing passion with greed and this desire for material success, for complacency, for entertainment, all of which go against the fundamental principles of a country that basically imagined itself into being, becomes very dangerous.
Also, and you and I were kind of saying this before we started talking formally here, that another thing that can happen if there's one of these monsters who arrives in sheep's clothing or at least benefactor's clothing and arrives in your midst, that person can begin to occupy your thoughts. Your thoughts ought to be your last realm of freedom. But if that person, if that dark beast begins to dwell in your thoughts all the time, in a way you're giving away your most precious real estate.
That is the main point. I mean, you know, when I used to talk about this even a few months ago, people could not imagine what I say to be truth because they think of imagination and ideas as something very abstract or even some things we escape to from reality. They don't understand that actually it is through imagination and ideas that we connect to reality and we're able to change reality. And the fact that we allow, for example, Mr. Trump to occupy all our waking hours, that in itself, even if we are thinking about him negatively and talking about him negatively, that in itself means that he has won because he now has control of our mind. We don't define ourselves. And what I learned in Iran was that the best way to resist any form of oppression to become more yourself, you know, to be able to define who you are and what you want and not constantly fall into the trap of being for or against and letting them define who you are.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the qualities that we need to cultivate, and some of these qualities often seem to be uniquely the province of artists or creative people, but I think you're saying that they're not uniquely there, are creativity, imagination, curiosity, and that kind of energy that sort of that says, okay, what else is out there besides this thing sitting right in front of me? What else is there?
Well, you
know, that is the whole point. You know, imagination. I mean, the basis of imagination is wanting to it is an instinct for survival. It is based on curiosity, because curiosity makes you come out of yourself and want to know about the world, whether it is through scientific means that you want to know about the world. Look at the environment. I mean, science wants to know how we can survive, and therefore, you know, there are certain things that we're doing to nature which is going to destroy us. And imagination and ideas help us understand the world, understand others, and through that understand others. Understand ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And without understanding the world, you can't control it. You can't change it. And you can't change yourself. And you know, America, when I was writing my last book, I kept reading American history. And one thing that I realized was that how much people who founded this country and changed this country, from Washington and Franklin to Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and Susan B. Anthony and Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, all of them understood the power of imagination, the power that this country needs public education based on imagination, literature, and science. That is what someone like George Washington, who was a military man, says. You know, you can't even defend yourself against an enemy if you cannot empathize with that enemy's mind and put yourself in their place.
Right. There have even been recent studies that indicate that people who read a lot of fiction develop empathy. They develop a greater capacity for empathy, because that's what you have to do. Well, I mean, look, when you're reading Lolita, you ultimately, Nabokov says, ultimately you have to enter the mind of Humbert Humbert. You have to enter the mind of somebody that you may regard as utterly reprehensible in order to understand the story.
What you just said, I think, is the basis of what we call democracy. Because when we talk about diversity of voices and the need for these voices, even those other than us, or especially those other than us, to be understood by us. And as you said, you know, it is so weird that authors can be really terrible people in many ways. You know, they're fallible like the rest of us. But once they take on the mantle of writing, once they start to write, they have to become democratic at that instance. And you know, some people these days think that we should only write about ourselves, think about ourselves, read about ourselves, you know. And I always thought that that is one of, apart from being the most boring thing in the world, actually writing is to constantly find the strangers that are outside and the stranger within you. Writing is always an investigation, and that investigation leads to better understanding. And that is the joy of reading and writing. And you know, Colin, it is amazing what we are doing to our system of education.
Mm-hmm.
That is what has become my main preoccupation. Taking music, taking poetry, taking art out of our public schools, out of kindergartens. I mean, what kind of a country are we building on? You know, so these are the questions that people like us now need to think. And I think we need to create a great movement, asking ourselves who's going to bail out imagination and ideas.
One thing that might encourage us, not that I've been able to see it yet, but I've been able to absorb enough of it, is that Broadway audiences are going crazy night after night for the story of Hamilton. And, you know, there are moments in that musical where Hamilton and Lafayette say to one another, "Immigrants, we get the job done." You know, it's almost as though the creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, correctly anticipated the moment that we're in, which is another thing that creative people do.
You go back to thousands of years ago and you see Aeschylus and Euripides predicted us. When I read Antigone and I think of the choice that the individual has to his or her own conscience and loyalty to the state, you know, it is all, I mean, literature is all about moral dignity and integrity of the individuals. And these days I keep thinking all the time about James Baldwin. And Baldwin used to say, artists are here to disturb the peace. And one reason art is dangerous is not because it makes you question the world. More dangerously, it makes you question yourself. It makes you not sleep well at night because not of how bad the others can be, but of what you are capable of. We have had a culture that has become too complacent. Even our candidates, the media talks about them in terms of repackaging themselves and rebranding themselves. It's so brazen, as if Trump and Hillary Clinton were toothpaste that we could rebrand. One moment they're this way and the next moment to sell themselves, they can become something else. We needed the right kind of trigger warning that if you go this way, you will pay for it. And everyone will pay. Every single one will pay.
I think it's also important to emphasize, and this gets back also to what you're saying about education, that everybody at some level is that kind of an artist. Maybe you're not James Baldwin, maybe you're not Lin-Manuel Miranda, but something that you're doing, you talked about America imagining itself into existence. Some way in which you're living, invites you to engage at a very imaginative level. If you have a garden at your house, if you're cooking wonderful food, if you're raising interesting dogs, whatever it is that you're doing, it's Philippe Petit in the documentary about walking between the World Trade Center towers. He says that he insists that every day be a work of art, that every single day be different from every other day, at least at some level.
You're completely right, and that is why I think, unlike what some people, including some academics, say, art is a celebration of life. And it is, especially the novel or when you read poetry, novel, plays, anything that has to do with creativity, it is about how extraordinary the ordinary is. Mm-hmm. That not a single person in this world is simply ordinary. Mm-hmm. And I feel that for too long, our educational system, especially in our colleges and higher education, they have separated themselves from the life from which art comes and the from the public from which our students come from and go to. And what we need is a new look. What we need is a new look at ourselves. And what we need is the courage to imagine what does not exist yet and try to bring it into existence. I felt for a long time that these times are very dangerous times, and I'm not trying to, become an aspirin to our woes. But I also feel this sense of excitement that this is a moment of transition, and it is up to us, ordinary people, to be able to take advantage and change it the way we imagine it should be. And last thing I wanted to say, I really appreciate what you said, that art is not just about Baldwin or Jacob Lawrence or all these fantastic creative people, because of the fact that when I was in Iran, what amazed me was the creativity and courage of ordinary people like the students I wrote about. And in America, I tell you, honest to God, I would not have survived if I had not been traveling to all these states, red and blue. And if I had not met these amazing people who had no big claims, but who created joy and beauty out of small details of life. That is why I'm so angry at our elite. That is why I'm so angry at them. This is a country of grassroots. From the war of revolution to civil war to civil rights movement, women's movements, gays movement, all of it came from we the people. And for me as an immigrant, that is what matters. I never for one moment thought that I have to go to the elite. I always felt that this is my chance in this country to imagine and to fight for that, for what I imagine with other people.
If we had a live audience, there would be wild applause right here. Instead, we have to say goodbye to Azar Nafisi, author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, Things I've Been Silent About, and The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. I thought you were just the voice my audience needed to hear today, Azar Nafisi.
I'm so glad I talked to you. It makes me feel better.
Okay. Well, we did that for...
We need to be in touch off or on air.
All right. Thank
good
you.
Luck.
Black Mud River, roll on forever. I don't care how deep or wide. If you got another side, roll, muddy river, roll.